suppose I'm a new manufacturer on the block, and I come up with a vastly improved polygraph that the examiners believe is better, and the examinees believe is better, and that in fact isn't better, or is worse, or it doesn't matter. What would you expect to happen if, you know, if I was to introduce the new improved model of the box?
That already happened. Can I draw a comparison to voice stress? There are a number of, and some of the panel members here actually saw us investigating the utility of such a device, and yet we do not, after a decade of researching the computerized voice stress analysis, not have any evidence that the audience level in detecting deception, whether it affects stress or not is another thing, which may or may not be related to deception. But if you go to local law enforcement in California, how would you go to one that you did in their selection process? What elicits the confession is known not to have your memory. And it's working. It's causing people to confess.
Are there studies of confessions under voice stress analysis that you know of?
Now, the vendors will produce, you know, pages and pages of anecdotes where people have confessed.
I'm going to exercise the chairman's prerogative and note that we would like to let the committee out for a little bit. We've been going since 8:30 and have a working dinner plan. So I know you have two other items on your list. I'm sorry, you're encouraging us to get to them before there was, because they're both ones that the committee is interested in.
So we're going to continue now, or we're
going to
take a break?
We're going to go now and then end. So.
Okay. I would like to finish what I was going to say about utility, but I guess the question I was asked is, utility in the absence of validity, do I favor it? Well, you know, take the money and run, any short-term benefits that you get from confessions, fine, but you can only count on it being short-term gains unless it's somehow connected with some kind of validity. Otherwise, it'll be readily exposed and you'll be worse off than you were before. Anyhow, a couple more things about utility. I indicated something about government reports that indicate a variety of claim aspects of utility. I don't see arrests, I don't see convictions, I don't see firings largely connected to these things. So my question as to whether or not whatever short-term benefits there are, unless there are behavioral predictive benefits that you asked about, Steve, unless those can be demonstrated for minor offenses, I'm not sure that the money that is being allocated for defense national security in terms of major issues, I'm not sure it's worth demonstrating. One third thing is I've had a small number of people have come to me in the last 2 or 3 years indicating as a result of what amounts to discovery sorts of things, that is either freedom of information requests or requests for administrative paperwork and so forth related to their denial for employment, which they sometimes request and sometimes get 2 or 3 years after the process, that it has come to their conclusion that somewhere in the polygraph process that admissions and confessions were claimed by polygraph examiners that they, the examinees, claim they never made. This is a different type of false confession. It's not one that was made to a crime. It was not one that was actually made by an examinee about something that they did. This is one that is alleged to have been made up by examinees. Is this a widespread behavior? Does it exist? I don't know. I don't have firsthand knowledge of it. But I do know that there have been agencies and so forth. The Bureau in the past, I'm not sure, but I don't even know what the Bureau still does this. Polygraph examiners in the Bureau are monitored by two groups, their advisors and mentors of the polygraph unit, too, or their so-called quality control review process. And they're also monitored by their supervisors and so forth in the field offices. People in the Bureau traditionally are evaluated on a yearly basis in terms of performance evaluation. They're done so based on how well they do in terms of various critical elements within their performance plan. One of the things for polygraph examiners used to be, and perhaps still is the number of confessions and admissions that they would get following deceptive polygraph results. Obviously, I think this is inappropriate. Forensic toxicologist, the notion that I would be rewarded for drug investigation is important to me. It's not only wrong, but if that were to be found out, in fact, to be the case, I would testify in court. That would be the end of me and the Bureau and anybody else who did that. So I think it's altogether inappropriate. But my point is that for the less than totally scrupulous polygraph examiner, that sort of motivation might be enough to do it. I also say that the number of people that have come to me are very small at this, but most people wouldn't know to do it. Most people know that they didn't get a job and somehow it was connected with a deceptive polygraph result. They'd have no way of knowing that a polygraph admission or confession was claimed. Most people, the process that you would have to go through in order to get this is horrendous. Freedom of information for most people is a very difficult thing. I have suggested that the few people who come to me report this to our Office of Professional Responsibility. I believe a few people have. I don't know what the results are. I'm not personally involved. So. But anyhow, I'd point that out. Okay, I'm going to skip a couple things. I was going to talk about polygraph deception. Polygraph deception occurs about 10 different times, and I wanted to talk to David about this. And the reason being is that clearly law enforcement under certain circumstances is allowed to engage in deception. Generally, those circumstances are narrow, and they're not generalized so as to be a part of the everyday job every day. They're also law enforcement sanctioned functions that are not for civilian polygraph examiners and so forth. So I'm not sure that there are not problems with deception. I think there are also problems with deception. One of the things I was going to talk about is the STEM test. You all participated, I think, in STEM tests, and it was suggested to you that somehow this would give you a warm and pleasant feeling for what a polygraph exam is, a control question test polygraph exam. In fact, a STEM test, although you choose a number and you answer no, in fact, it looks like you're doing a lie test. You can get exactly the same results with a STEM test by saying yes, by saying no to all questions, or by not answering at all. Really what you've got probably is a concealed information test. It has nothing to do with a controlled question test. It has nothing to do with polygraph screening.
Well, I should say that some of the people on the committee did subject themselves to STEM tests. We also observed TDS and related control question techniques being given. So. I don't think that that anybody represented to us that a STEM test was equivalent to a polygraph examination.
Okay. Well, certainly not. If anybody, there were some comments that were made in the public meeting following your having been given STEM tests or the opportunity to take STEM tests. And to tell you the truth, I didn't know that you had even seen tests, let alone participated in it, but if you had actually seen them, that obviously should have been of some value to you. Enough. Okay, a couple of issues that we want to talk about. Bias. I suggested that there is investigative bias in many polygraph exams. And I think that there are well-known cases where we can suggest that polygraph results have been influenced by investigative and or prosecutor opinion, and investigative direction has been influenced wrongly by polygraph exams. There's bias going both directions. But I think that very clearly, this is anecdotal evidence, and I think I'm not going to suggest that television is a basis for it, but probably the best anecdotal evidence of polygraph bias is that the 60 Minutes program that was done in the mid-1980s, I guess, prior to the EPPA, to some extent that may have, they claim that some role in the passage of that legislation. What happened there was three fictitious crimes were described to three different polygraph examiners representing three different polygraph agencies, three different examinees, three different people were presented to polygraph examinees for polygraph exams. All three polygraph exams and polygraph examiners, all three polygraph examiners were told that the defendants were likely guilty. And we know they're guilty. In fact, there was no crime committed. All three were found to be deceptive. Again, anecdotal sorts of things having to do with perhaps that there is some bias with suggestion and so forth. And the same sort of thing. I'm not suggesting that criminal investigators are wrongly or intentionally mislead polygraph examiners, but I am suggesting that any time they're wrong about their prosecutor opinion, it may well affect polygraph examiners. There are other thing that we want to talk about, and you have before you, is a handout that came, was given out in the early 1990s to the polygraph community. Another publicly disseminated by Godfrey, and what I'd like to draw your attention to is pages 14 through 22. Pages 14 through 22, when I gave you this thing as a whole, just to put it in perspective, because I'm only interested in these pages. Pages 14 through 22 have to do with an analysis of racial bias. What we're looking at here are two different probable control or probable lie control question tests, two different formats, the mixed general question test, MGQT, and the zone comparison test. What we have here, I'll tell you what we know about the study, I'll tell you what we don't know about the study. I was not a participant in this study. I just have to be the recipient of the handouts and description. What we have here is a study that had a fairly high number of participants in this, over 1,000 people, 921 whites, 220 blacks. And the bottom line to this whole thing, because we're short for time, I'll just draw your attention to page 22, the last one. What this has to do with is the zone comparison test. We're looking at a particular cell subgroup of people, that is, innocent examinees. What we're looking at, if you look at the right, far right numbers for deception indicated in the bar graphs, you'll see that those deception indicated, which of course for innocent examinees are false positives, the rate is roughly twice that for blacks as it is for Caucasians. What can be drawn about, what can be told about the study? Does this indicate anything about racial bias? I don't know, because there's not enough detail known about this. Well, but this study suggested, because there are very large numbers of people here, I would suggest that this probably, these were student exams and probably were military recruits. What would that indicate to me?
Did you say they were student examiners, yeah, or examinees, or both?
Well, what I'm suggesting is that these are, I want to tell you what a student examiner is. These are people who are federal law enforcement or intelligence community agents going for polygraph training. I think it's 14 weeks. 14 weeks. So these will be people somewhere between 0 and 14 weeks conducting polygraph exams. I guess actually 3 to 5 weeks after they actually begin doing exams. I want to raise a straw man for why this data might be discounted. In fact, this data was never published. There has been other racial data published out of the market. This was not, and I think, inappropriately. I don't have any problem with the data that was published having been published, but I think there's some problem with this having been ignored. This was referred to by Sheila Reed the last time, although she didn't present this handout. It might be suggested that the reason for not doing this was that these were student examiners, and there might be some problem with student examiners. I think in order to see why that would be a straw man argument, you have to look at two things. One, what would be the source of racial bias? Two, the nature of student examiners. Racial bias can come from two sources. It can come from either the examinee or the examiner. If it were to come from the examinee, perhaps there might be some physiological differences that might be noted in examinees, whites and blacks, and so forth. It also might be possible that any racial bias might be coming from the examiner. If in fact that were the case, it might be behavioral sorts of things. It might be lifetime experiences and so forth. What I would suggest is that the notion that somebody would suggest that this data ought to be discounted if in fact it had to do with student examiners is look at who that is. Who's a student examiner? Well, in the case of the FBI, which happens to us fairly well, the typical FBI polygraph examiner, somebody who has 15 to 20 years in the FBI, is between age 40 and 50. What I will suggest is any racial bias that he has is a result of those experiences and reinforcements in life through age 40 to 50. Have absolutely nothing to do with any technical training that he may receive during 14 weeks of Godfrey. Again, I can't say what this data is. I can't say a great deal about it. I can simply say that it was withheld and never published. It was suggested at the time that it was not yet ready for publication after it was initially released. I'm not suggesting at all that it has anything to do with the cover-up. What I am suggesting that somehow data just haven't published in the last 10 years, and I suspect that even though you all requested this kind of information, you probably didn't receive it. And if you didn't receive it, what else did you receive? Something that's I can say about that study.
Well, it's interesting, if you put it 21 and 22 together, you know, in 21, you're doing a better job of getting the guilty examinees, but you put them together, and assuming it's 50-50, they're saying that the blacks are guilty 56% of the time and the whites 43% of the time. I mean, that it's kind of, maybe that's the phenomenon that's explaining both of these charts. It's kind of like the base rate.
One more time again, tell me that again.
Okay, if you look at chart 21.
Page 21?
Page 21, right. Okay, now I'm looking at the DI is 76.9% for blacks and 70.3% for whites. That's the three-way chart. So, deception intake, that means they really are guilty, so.
They are guilty examinees and they're found to be deception, so that's.
Right, so that's a true thing. So, for the accuracy, the problem here, there's various ways you can go wrong, but the problem is that the overall calling blacks guilty was 56%, and the overall calling whites guilty was 43%. That's the sort of the cause of the problem, is they've got the base rate wrong for blacks and whites. They think blacks are more likely to be guilty. So it's not so much a discrimination thing as they just have the wrong base rate. It's not a big
problem. Anyway, for your consideration, I'll know more about it than what I told you about.
So I don't know if these were all conducted with the same protocols.
Or at least two different protocols.
My guess would be, and it's again simply nothing more than a guess, what happens based on my own experience as a graduate of the basic polygraph school, while you're there as a polygraph examiner, as I recall, you conduct about 50 polygraph exams while a student has another portion of your time is spent doing exams and a portion of the classroom and so forth. So I suspect that these 1,000 exams came from some number of federal polygraph examining trainees.
Yep, they might have been practicing different protocols.
Well, I'm sure that they were, because what happens is when you go through those 50 exams that you conduct, at least the time I went through, as I recall, you begin with some comparison tests. The second thing you do is NGQT. They're basically all doing the same thing, they're probably doing the same thing. As a matter of fact, they're probably more uniform at that point than they are at any point in their life. Once they get out of their own job and they're doing much less control over while you're actually a student, not by being monitored by the instructor and you're being videotaped, audio videotaped, and so forth, everything. I suspect that that is probably the most uniform exams that are ever done by polygraph examiners.
I think it's exception to that. I think we're all audio and videotaped every exam, so I don't.
And as you folks know, we have four sets of evaluation on every exam that UE does. Perhaps if Mr. Richardson's career, I don't know how many tests he ran. Maybe that's his experience, but that's not the case. And I take a strong exception to that. Maybe you know what
we do. Would videotapes or audiotapes of exams be available?
Ours are.
Because there are questions that have come up often about at what point did confessions occur, at what point did admissions occur, at what questions did things go, you know, the score, and often the answer is that the data can't be retrieved from the published articles, but it sounds like in principle it would be possible to go back and reconstruct exam by exam exactly what happened when.
It's a lot of work. You just have to know the admissions, of course. You wouldn't care if they didn't admit it.
Dave, as he has before, that in his program that polygraph exams or audio and video tape does, because I did one before, I think, in the hearing daily headquarters. I congratulate you for that, because I think that is useful. But there are many agencies, including the one that I formally work for, that does not audio and video tape its polygraph exams. Where might that come into play? I suggested to you that there are people who have suggested that admissions and confessions have been claimed and in fact were never made. Obviously, one is going to dispute that and it's going to be something other than he said. If in fact you do have a Sixth Amendment right to confront witnesses against you, it would be very useful to audio videotapes. Amongst other things that I would suggest to you all is beyond anything that you might suggest about the overall use of polygraph, that you would suggest everybody audio videotape exams, seeing no reason whatsoever. It shouldn't be done by, but there should never be an exception where that's not done. And these ought to be readily made available to examinees and those representatives. But to the extent that Dave and his group do that, great, I applaud it.
Drew, could you clarify, can you talk about the context of that, how it's made? Was this a mock crime study or a synthesis of all the studies this time?
Actually, there are four different studies, I think, presented here. Only page 14 through 22 have to do with the racial study. So nothing beyond, nothing in front of page 14 pertains to what I was just talking about.
Right. So there were 1,100 odd people in this study, as I understand it. And then, was this a mock crime study? And who were the examinees?
I don't know that. My guess would be, again, because we're talking about a large number of people, it's nothing but my guess that the examinees probably were military recruits, which are the typical examinee population for examiners training. Probably 18-year-old is generally 17-year-old.
And Doc Pine was where? Doc Pine was not coming.
No, I presume this data was presented in the early 1990s. It was collected shortly there before it would have been enhanced now.
Basically, what we're looking at is demographic information collected on examiners while training. Not a controlled study by any stretch of the imagination. And all of that data is just think about what happened to those exams. Examiner trainers, their first exam, and their 15th exam. All of that.
How do those exams work?
Examinees are troops that are supplied by the military base to Dalton High as part of the base arena. That was done at Fort McClellan, passes, and then by Fort Jackson. We saw that as a
good. Some of them day after day, the same ones or something.
And so they were sort of, and were they put through a mock crime scenario?
Yeah. Were they found guilty or something?
One was like they had a mock crime scenario that they were used to.
Some people are there because they're being discharged and they're in a holding status, and some of them come day after day after day, and they in great part enjoy coming because it's a hell of a lot better in the air conditioning polygraph suite than out in the blowing water.
So if it says that there were 80 exams, say, of a black subject, examinees. These aren't necessarily 8 black examinees. These might be 5 black examinees who make the exam.
The answer is yes.
Yeah. I mean, the number of subjects in the study might have been 10.
People come back more than once. That's only a number of them. We think those that aren't in formal training, they can be excused to be mock teammates for the training.
Okay. So is this typical of the studies that Fort Jackson?
Some are common.
There are no research studies conducted on the examinees, examiner students, and those examinees. That's just training.
There was a contract
by instruction. Has nothing to do with research. It was similar to when
we saw the mock prior on the base.
You saw the mock prior training out in the woods. That's training. I had to remind you, that's not research. We're not out there controlling that. We're not.
As opposed to the stuff being in the federal building, or federal building, where the subjects were solicited from the community, these soldiers, the closest thing that you could compare them to being your participant pool would be a Navy commercial.
Okay, so in the they're pseudo volunteers.
Okay, so in the three Reed studies that the two published at one time got in Alabama,
Reed studies came from the retreat. Best I can recall was all came from.
Not the earlier Bartlett study. That was like this population.
There were early Doug Pye studies that were done on recruits.
Yes. And so we'd like to get some of those.
Sleeping recruits. Very important.
Is there any information in any of the studies that would look at the issue of differential physiologic responsiveness by racial or other demographic? situation where the board is using that term as a technical sense, the examinee or the examiner might be a member of a group that is typically viewed as something advantage socially or viewed as unique or unusual versus being another member of the peer group. Any data at all?
No control study. Everything we're talking about is pretty much information that can be gathered from looking at the records and did forward to the committee. What we found about how that term was used, assessing the relation of that to the current study.
Do you have, you say that you're doing test measures, has any analysis where you look at the relevance of your measurement based on, you're saying that there's different examiners you're testing? We had seen data from your lab about the same exam, two different scores, but now you have the same individual with different exams. You can look at the liability score. Have you done those analysis?
Again, the data is collected on the groups, it's not research data to us. We don't consider that.
You might even look at, if the examinee by schooling or changes, such as you do it, even if it wasn't research, just for purposes of evaluating whether there's a change in standard or procedure across the board. Have you looked into that?
We really do not mix the controlled studies and research with the training.
What are the recommendations that you folks have on a database so for future research? We revise that whole thing. We've gone back and built the first test we had, entered that data into that database. That is available for this panel or anybody else to come back and analyze the data.
Okay, I want to end on just one note. The one thing I do know, and I'm a person, and I know very little about that study, and we don't want to claim any significance, but I will put it in perspective. It was presented by Gordon Marlin, who was Andy's predecessor, one of several chiefs of research, I guess, about by the time. You know, it was presented as serious, credible research by him. You know, it was later not published, so that's all I can say about that. With regard to the last thing that I want to talk about, I'd like to talk about a new paradigm using ERP technology in order to do limited screening, specific screening, and a counterterrorism application. And because I'm losing my voice, and so you can hear a different voice for the next and last 5 minutes, I'm going to ask Larry Farwell to present that.
Yeah, I'd be happy to. By the way, I wasn't planning to, so I haven't. So I'll write off.
First of all, they don't join us.
Thank you. And now Barbara Torrey.
Put her aside.
First of all, this document is not, it's designed for the lay public, was not designed for this group, so I hope you'll forgive the idea.
I'd like a formal request, just in case we don't get it in later. At the back of it, however, is reference to formal sentence. I know we have one, because I believe the
following Smith.
But could you be sure that we have copies of each?
Sure.
That way we will not get looking at them. All right. If we don't get them for sure, we will miss them.
All right. What we can tell, and I'll try to be very brief, what we can tell definitively is what information a person has or does not have. And the way that we do this is by flashing, some of you are very familiar with this process, I'll assume that some of you aren't, and describe it. By flashing on a screen three types of stimuli and measuring the brain responses. Some of those stimuli we call targets. Those are information that are known to the subject and are known to be known. For example, if we're investigating a specific crime, there would be details about the crime that we know the person knows because it's been told in the course of interrogation. Those are going to have a P300 in response to the, and we also have the person press a special button when any target comes up. So they are a relatively rare category. They're a minority of the stimuli. They are going to be significant for the person. They're pressing a button. They're doing a special task for those. We know they're going to get a P300 in response to those. You get a P300 to a stimulus that is significant and that you take note of at the time. Most of the stimuli are irrelevant. They are details about the crime or situation under investigation, which are
not actually accurate details, but would be equally plausible for an innocent suspect. For example, if a target were the murder weapon, say the person knew what the murder weapon was, and irrelevant might be another possible murder weapon that wasn't used in that murder. So we're going to get a P300 in response to the targets in every case, whether the person committed a crime or not, because they know about them. We won't get it in response to the irrelevance. The interesting stimuli we call probes. Those are details about the crime or the situation under investigation, which are known only to the best of our knowledge, are known only to the investigators and to the perpetrators. Or in the case where we're trying to establish a group affiliation where they're known by people who belong to this group, for example, FBI agents, and they're not generally known to others. If the person has the critical information, then he will also get a P300 in response to these probe stimuli. If he doesn't have the critical information, he won't. And these plots, they were originally in color, so you can't see them very well here, but here in this case, they're only getting a P300, which is this bump over on the left, in response to the targets, which are red line, although you can't see it here. They aren't to the other two. This graph is one where they knew it, the information, and you're getting that P300 response to both of those. I'm not going to talk a lot about this negativity that follows the P300, which is the second aspect of what I call a memory encoding for the alpha-facile electroencephalographic response. I can talk about that in detail. I mean, I have some of the publications and other literature, but I don't need to get into that now, except to say that you get a specific response when you recognize something significant. You don't get it when you don't have that information. And what we showed in a number of different studies with about 170 subjects is we can tell who's an FBI agent and who's not. We did that with 100% accuracy. We can tell who's an expert in military medicine and who is not. We did that with 100% accuracy. We can tell who has participated in specific laboratory-generated events, such as a mock crime, and who has not. We did that also with 100% accuracy.
Excuse me, sir.
Yeah?
I haven't seen these studies. You have these studies?
I can give you all kinds of stuff.
There's the one article I have seen is the one that appeared in Psych Physiology and wasn't characterized by 100% accuracy. Things changed since then.
Yes.
Okay. What's changed?
Oh, well,
that's the only scientific article I've seen on this.
Okay. I'll give you the following Smith article, which also reviews the other articles, and I can give you back to the reports of the CIA, which also includes the other stuff. In the original follow-on doctrine study, we did a couple of things differently. One is, I only looked at this much of the waveform, and so you have less data points, and if you look at more of the waveforms, you get more data points. We were able to get a higher statistical confidence if there are equal differences along here to the level of differences along here, which it turned out that there were. That's one point. Perhaps a more important point is that in the following Dodgson study, the targets were irrelevant. And in the subsequent studies, the targets were relevant. So that meant they were more similar to the probes for a subject who had the information. And that proved to be something that was useful. So in the following Dodgson study, we had 12.5% indeterminate. The balance, 87.5%, we got the correct answer when we made a determination, but 12.5% we couldn't make one way or the other. They weren't errors, but they were indeterminate. Subsequent studies, we didn't have any indeterminates, and all the decisions were correct.
What's your definition of a significant stimulus? What does that mean?
Could you use that term? Do you mean when I was talking about the targets or when I was talking about the probes?
I guess I'm trying to visualize what would or would not be a candidate for a probe or a target.
Well, it would be a detail about the investigated situation, which was considered by whoever was structuring a test to be salient enough that it would be likely to be recognized by the individual. And there is not an absolute, I mean, as all of you who study memory know, there's not an absolute rule for what is going to be significant and what is not. Now, there is literature on what's memorable and what's not, and you can structure a test that takes that literature into account. What you can't do is be absolutely certain that you pick good probes. And basically, when we presented this in court, what I said in my testimony, I said, what I can tell you for sure is this particular individual recognizes these particular facts about the crime. And in another case, he didn't recognize certain facts about the crime. Now, what I'm not going to say is, therefore, we know for sure he's innocent, therefore, we know for sure he's guilty. What you can do is you can say, this if somebody doesn't know, for example, in the Harrington case, which is an actual murder case, if he doesn't know where the guy was when he was shot, doesn't know where the guy ran allegedly after he shot him, he doesn't know what obstacle he had to get through to get to the getaway car, he doesn't know where he drove the getaway car, doesn't know where he had to go to get to the crime scene, does that give you reasonable doubt that in fact maybe he really didn't do the crime? It doesn't absolutely prove that he didn't, but it is relevant data. So I mean, that's one limitation that I do not say we can say for certain that a person did or didn't do something. We can say he does or doesn't have certain details about that stored in his brain, and then it's going to be a judgment call by a judge, a jury, or whoever as to what we conclude about his behavior. What I will say is it's relevant data. What I will not say is it provides us with an absolute certainty. Go ahead.
Is there a difference if I were a polygraph examiner who was used to conducting guilty knowledge tests?
Right.
And we simply unplugged the polygraph, put on your head band. Granted, we're changing theory, we're changing the parameter, and so on. But are we changing the examination other than what we are measuring? Are
we changing it in
GKT with a different response?
No, we're changing it in a number of very fundamental ways. One thing, the time course of the responses is very different, so you couldn't actually just run a polygraph with headband on and expect to get anything. But more importantly than that, in a GKT conducted with conventional polygraph, what they typically do is they give you five options, and if you have the largest response to the relevant option, that's considered to be an indication that this is the relevant option. We have three types of stimuli, not two, but three. And one of them is a target where we know, not because of the emotional response, but because of an information processing process that takes place, that they recognize that as significant. Context updating takes place. If you buy the current theories about V300, you get that in response to the target. You don't get it in response to the irrelevant. You get it to the probe if and only if you recognize the probe. So our mathematical comparison essentially says, okay, we know about this line, that's where our signal is present. We know about this line, that's where it's not present. We want to look at this third line, and we classify it as looking like this line or looking like this line.
You're positive and negative control.
Exactly. I want to talk actually about a couple of limitations. One thing I think everyone on this side of the room would agree with me, and I've discussed this with Dave and with others of you, I would not advocate, and it would not work, to take this technology and say, okay, what we're now trying to do at DOE, which is to find out if FBI pre-employment screening or CIA pre-employment screening, which is to find out if someone has done any one of perhaps 1,000 different things he might have done and we don't know which one it is, and we try to use this technology to find that out, it would not work. And I'm not advocating that it would work because, well, for obvious reasons, we would have to have 1,000 different stimulus sets, and even then we might not hit on the right one. Now, if on the other hand, we want to know if a person has participated in the planning of this September 11th bombings, we know a lot about that, and we can determine that with a quite high degree of probability of a correct answer. If we want to know if somebody's an FBI agent, we can determine that. Now, somewhere in the middle is something I would call specific screening, which is not general screening of have they ever done anything that we wouldn't like, but rather, has this person through Osama bin Laden's training camps, or he says he's an innocent Afghani student. So we've narrowed down the field to what we don't have to worry about him being an SDR agent, probably. But has he been through that training? If we can detect an FBI agent, I'd say there's a pretty good probability we could detect somebody like that. So in a limited screening, this could have some value. In a specific issue situation, it could have some value. In a general screening, which is what the polygraph is most commonly used for in the government, this doesn't solve the problem.
How specific are the recommendations? If I show a stimulus similar to what you've actually done, the real gun is a black 38, and I show you a darkish 45 caliber.
Well, let me answer how we address that concern. We tell the person, you're going to see, for example, usually it's words rather than pictures, and one of the reasons is the words you can limit the meaning of them more precisely than you can a picture, which is so information. We say, for example, the Harrington, I say, all right, you're going to see what was on the ground behind the building where the perpetrators allegedly ran after the murder. But before showing him that series of stimuli, I said, okay, did you do it? No. did you come running out from behind that building as testified by your accuser in the trial with a shotgun? No. Have you ever been behind the building? You knew what building we were talking about? No. So you wouldn't know what's behind the building? No. Would you know if it was weeds and grass, which happened to be waist high and that was what it was, or concrete and blacktop, or a gravel road? He said no. So what we've done is, after that, we'll show him a list of all the stimuli and say, if one of these is particularly significant to you for any specific reason that has nothing to do with the crime, tell me about it and we can eliminate it. And in fact, in the Harrington case, there was one. The name that I had made up was, in fact, a name of somebody who had been an attorney on a previous case of his. He said, oh, well, I know that name. And so it was supposed to be an irrelevant stimuli. The stimulus would be eliminated. So what we've done is, things are significant in context. And we've set the context by telling them, here are the items that you're going to see. Here is what the meaning of these items is in reference to this particular crime. And one of these is the right one, and the others aren't. And if he indicates that he knows what the right one is, or has some reason to believe what the right one is, then we would eliminate that stimulus. So we have a situation where he's just told us, these are all the same to me. None of these look any different. None of these are any more likely to be the right answer than the rest. And then bing, 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 we get a P300 saying he really recognizes the right one. That's a good indication that we've, insofar as possible, eliminated the plausible alternative hypotheses as to why he's recognized that.
Well, I think Merrill and Fong are completely, you give irrelevant and probe, so relevant to the crime. You give relevant that are relevant to the person but not to the crime.
Well, actually,
kind of measure might be just tuning out.
We do need
a baseline for relevant but not relevant to crime.
Right. We have a third. I call those targets. They are relevant. In fact, they're relevant to the person, and in fact, they're also in the best implementation of this, the most effective one. They're actually relevant to the crime, but he knows them. The probes are relevant to the crime, and he either doesn't know them, or at least he doesn't have any way of knowing unless he committed the crime. By the way, when you're using acronyms, one of the reasons this came up of using targets that could have been probes, the targets that are in fact relevant to the crime or to the situation implicated, rather than just that we make relevant by saying, okay, these are the targets, push a button. We were using FBI acronyms as one way of identifying FBI agents. And if you use an acronym, if you use targets that are in fact acronyms, then the person knows the targets and doesn't know the irrelevance. He reads the targets as acronyms, he reads the irrelevance as random letter streams. And in fact, you get your recognition of an acronym is faster than your recognition of a random letter stream. So we found that we got both latency and amplitude results with the targets looking like the probes when they recognized the probes as acronyms, and we didn't when the probes, in fact, were not recognized as acronyms because they were random letter streams because the person wasn't a member of the FBI. There are other ways in which it's advantageous to have the targets be things which are relevant to the crime or situation under investigation, because then they're just like the probes to the guilty or knowledgeable person, except for the fact that he's not acknowledging that he knows them because the only way he knows them is from doing the crime.
Let me come back just for a second to Kevin's question. I mean, if this technique works terrific, then you know, if you get another technique that'll help, that's wonderful, but I worry about the danger sort of overselling any technique. This is a form of recognition memory, P300 and 400, some combination of two. But everything I've ever seen about such tests, either physiologically or behaviorally, is that you get false alarms and you miss it. And perhaps because of similarity of the distractors or targets or failures of memory or what have you. And claims that you get 100% accuracy unless you're doing something that you're not telling us about, maybe it's in the studies. Seems to contravene the everything we know about memory that suggests that just not always going to work. Sometimes you're just going to forget. You won't recognize the stimuli because they forget them. Or they will respond to something because it's similar. And again, you could have misses or false alarms, but are you claiming that you don't get those or are you going to wait now to get them?
Every other scientist throughout history has always gotten misses and false alarms. But not me.
Yeah. that's not what I'm saying.
Most probably what examiners tell us the same thing.
And first of all, about overselling, I mean, I'm concerned about that as well, and I'm much more conservative about this than quite a number of other people. Now, when I say 100% accuracy, I want to be very careful of what I mean by that. What I mean is that it's a retrospective statement in terms of the accuracy that we found in the studies that have been done. It is not a claim that this is 100% accurate technique, and it's been misrepresented that way to the chagrin of everybody who, well, of myself and everybody else involved. One reason, there are a number of things we can do to make it more robust. One thing is we collect a large number of trials, and that improves our signal-to-noise ratio. Another thing is we don't hang our hat on one probe. What we're distinguishing is this guy an FBI agent or not, say, for example, or did he participate in this event or not. So if we have an aggregate response of a dozen items, one of those items may be very weak. One of those items he may not even remember. The overwhelming response comes from the larger number of items he, in fact, does remember. And if we were trying to get 100% accuracy of a hit, a recognizable hit on each single item, we undoubtedly would not get it. But in making the distinctions we've made so far, did this guy do this event or not, has he had this training or not, we've been able to make that distinction. I do not predict that we'll always make it accurately in the future. I'd say it's unlikely that we'll get false positives and false negatives, but they're going to be indeterminates, and eventually probably there will be false positives and false negatives. I think they'll be very, very small in number, though, provided the tests are well structured and you use
and you have lots of information. Yeah, we're asking about
how many probes would be a practical test.
Well, a good test, I'd say, I'd like to have about 30 probes. In the Harrington case, I had six because it was all I could find.
30? These ERP responses that you have in your front page, I mean, we do our ERP work, and occasionally I find individuals who show beautiful data on this type. But you know as well that you get.